County Supervisors back in session. We're going to move to Community Development Planning Division. Good morning, Julie.
Good morning, Haley Lane, Community Development Director. So staff has prepared a pretty comprehensive slide deck, because as you all see in your staff report packages, there's a pretty large Willing Snack white paper. So the slide deck is going to talk about, you know, some common issues and themes that, you know, we've experienced, as well as potential policy recommendations and other considerations. So my plan this morning is to go through this slide deck, and there's going to be a lot of information thrown at you just now. So, you know, if we need a second meeting to talk about more detailed policy recommendations or other things, you know, we'd be happy to do that. So anyways, Willing Snack purpose. So the purpose of Willing Snack is to preserve agricultural land by discouraging premature or unnecessary conversion to urban and non-agricultural uses. It was established in 1965 and allowed counties to enter into voluntary contracts with landowners. These contracts restrict land to commercial agriculture and compatible uses that do not displace farming. Participating landowners receive reduced property taxes based on agricultural use value, not market value. State law requires counties to adopt rules for the creation and management of the agricultural preserves and contracts. I would say, I think there's about four or five counties that do not participate in Willing Snack, one of that being San Francisco, for obvious reasons. The others are Del Norte County, Yuba County, and Inyo County. Imperial County also, they, I believe since 2009, they have stopped amending any contracts, accepting new contracts, so they're just letting the existing contracts roll out into either the end of the contract term or when the land changes over.
Whose contract is it? Is it ours or is it the state of California?
So it's between, you know, the property owner and the county.
It is?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank
yeah.
you.
And so the main theme behind all of this with the Willing Snack is Willing Snack is intended to limit sprawl by keeping farmland in production and concentrating growth in existing urban areas. And so something I want the board to think about as I go through this slide deck is, how do planners prohibit sprawl? One of our, you know, there's a few traditional tools, and so one of that being requiring large minimum parcel sizes, right? Also prohibiting further subdivision of land, limiting non-compatible development in surrounding areas, or concentrating urban development near communities. Next slide.
So I think I know this question because it's a contract, but does the contract follow the land or follow the owner?
It follows the owner.
Okay.
And we will talk about contract terms and those fun things in the next few slides. But yes.
Thank you.
So, history of Willing Snack. So, as mentioned, it was created in 1965 in a response to increasing development pressures on ag lands after World War II. Since the 1980s, Willing Snack lands have remained stable at approximately 16 million acres statewide. About a third of private land and about half of the state's agricultural land is within Willing Snack. So the state offset county revenue loss through subvention payments up until 2009. So since 2009 until today, the subvention funding has been eliminated and counties now bear the full fiscal impact of Willing Snack, which we will also talk about in some later slides. Local history of Willing Snack. So this graphic is just to highlight, you know, the key changes and themes that have happened since the inception of the program. And so for Siskiyou County, our program began in 1969, and there have been a number of amendments and changes that have occurred, you know, in response likely to the changing agricultural landscape, with our most recent update occurring in 2024. As you all remember, we, you know, added some better definitions, you know, made some concise language updates, added some additional uses and things like that. Next slide. So what is Willing Snack? Willing Snack is a voluntary contract between a landowner and the county. It is a property tax reduction program based on agricultural use. It is a land conservation tool to preserve farmland, and it is administered locally by counties. Next slide. So what Willing Snack isn't? It is not an entitlement. Participation is voluntary. It is not a tax sheltering mechanism or automatic tax relief. The tax relief requires enrollment and continued compliance. It is not permanent conservation. The contracts are typically 10-year renewable agreements. It is not zoning. It does not change or alter the allowable uses within a zoning district. And it is not a safety net. So it does not guarantee farm income or protect against any market risk. Common misconceptions. So these are a lot of common misconceptions we hear throughout the community. So just, you know, wanted to make everyone aware. This is just something that we hear a lot. Any agricultural land automatically qualifies. That is not true. The county is required to approve all contracts. Once the land is enrolled, it stays forever. The program is meant to help landowners financially. The program benefits the county financially, or that hobby farms or farms of low production are required to be included in the program. Next slide. County program requirements. So I have generalized our requirements here for purposes of discussion, but three key themes, right? So the land must be located in an agricultural preserve. The land must meet parcel size requirements and use requirements. And the contract must be a single owner contract. Next slide. County program issues. So these are four key themes that staff has recognized as issues, or the board has brought forward as issues. And so within the white paper, we took a look at each issue, discussed them, provided a little bit of a case study on how other counties handle these issues, as well as some other policy recommendations and considerations. So the four key themes that were discussed within the paper were acreage minimums, soils analysis, commercial viability, and water use changes in agricultural viability. Next slide. So acreage minimums. So I would say that Siskiyou County, albeit we are a large county and the ag within the community typically requires large acreage, such as rangeland, hay production, livestock, those types of uses. We actually have a very low, flexible acreage minimum standard. So prime is 10, non-prime is 40. I would say that is the typical, like, lowest minimums that we saw throughout looking at other county requirements. I would say counties that are similar to our type of agriculture actually have much higher acreage minimums. So Modoc County, I think their prime is like 80 acres and their non-prime is like 200 or something like that. So just for some context, I would say we have very flexible acreages for landowners to participate in. A lot of counties also require income verification in addition to acreage minimum. So there are some counties where, okay, if you meet the acreage minimum, you also have to meet the certain income verification requirements that they have. So, you know, however many thousand an acre or something like that. Next slide. Soils analysis. So soils analysis is a tool that's commonly used throughout most of the counties. The ones on the list on the PowerPoint all have soils somewhere as a mechanism within the analysis. So with Siskiyou County, we use it as a tool for recommending approval or denial of contract, right? So with Siskiyou County, if you meet the average soils requirements, you can be recommended for approval. Some other counties handle it a little bit differently. For example, Yolo and Kern, they talk about it administratively within their staff report as a tool to define the soils that may be recommended for approval. But again, Yolo and Kern, they also have higher minimum acreage requirements. So and they also have requirements more geared towards irrigation because, you know, they're south of the state, and that's somewhat of a priority down there. There's a lot of counties you'll see on here, Lassen, Modoc, up north, that they do discuss soils, but it's more of a minimal or informal way. It's just, you know, to discuss the property. And again, that's because their acreage minimums are so high. So the counties likely don't see that as necessarily like a necessary tool to even discuss, right? So if you're already requiring that you have to have 300 acres, you know, you're not really going to care too much about the production of the soil, right? So counties look at it much differently throughout the state. Commercial viability. So a lot of counties do a better job at better defining what that is. You know, obviously it's assumed within our guidelines that yes, you would be doing and producing income on the property would be a bona fide commercial operation, but we really don't have that language in our guidelines. Other counties do. So that can look like a number of things. Like I mentioned, income verification requirements, you know, a management plan, leasing agreement, stocking rates, you know, certain densities of livestock or crops, things like that. So there are ways that we can look at that, you know, but I would say that, you know, our assumption on that is a little bit more general compared to other counties. Some counties, I think even Stanislaus, for example, they require like a 100% parcel coverage of ag, and no, you know, the single family home cannot even be on the parcel, right? So then there's counties that take that to the nth degree, you know, when they're discussing what is commercially viable and what can occur on the land. Next slide. Water use changes. So this has been, you know, a new issue that's been brought forward with the change of property ownership into conservation easements, conservation groups. There have been concerns brought forward from the board on water use changes, diversions, things of that nature. We took a look in other county Williamson Act guidelines, and no one talks about water explicitly, and they don't really have much parameters on it, but in ways we can think about better monitoring or enforcing the intent of Williamson Act, right, which is prohibiting sprawl and supporting bona fide commercial agriculture. What are findings or parameters that we can potentially put in place when discussing how we want these properties to develop agriculturally, right? You know, ways to think about it is if there's substantial water use change, you would be potentially just required to come to the board to discuss a contract change or a rescission or reentry. In discussing commercial viability, right? Or do we require certain stocking rates or certain income verification be a part of the analysis process now to somewhat try to alleviate these issues that we're seeing where, you know, private property owners are getting into conservation easements or selling their property to conservation groups and then what that looks like, right? So just some things to think about. And in the next few slides, we'll talk about how that affects contract changes. So just some general key observations. I would say Siskiyou County is consistent with, you know, our prime and non-prime, you know, acreage minimums. There are many differences amongst counties that often relate to commercial viability standards and administrative review procedures rather than minimum acreage alone. Counties that allow flexibility rely on clear policies and documented findings, and strengthening review criteria related to agricultural viability, grazing capability, soil productivity, and operational context can improve consistency and defensibility. Financial impact of the program. So there is currently over 400,000 acres under the Williamson Act program, and so that equates to about 600,000 in foregone tax revenue. So as we talk about policy recommendations and considerations, I would, you know, ask that the board keeps that number in mind. AB 1265 and SB 1353, this is something that the county has never gone down the road with, but essentially these bills shorten contracts dates from 10 years to 9 years to offset, you know, the local funding that's lost with the subvention funding. And so it's a local decision. It would be something that would be passed by the board with the resolution, but the purpose of it, it recaptures about 10% of tax savings for local use to maintain program funding. Next slide, please. And so this is a graphic that we created just to kind of show what that looks like. So counties that have these programs in place, right, it shortens the contract date by a year, and so you're off, you know, you capture 10% of those savings. And so those are just tools in the toolkit that some counties utilize to offset, you know, all of the funding that they're subsidizing with the program. Next slide. So within the paper, we discussed a number of potential policy recommendations, and so we wanted to just highlight a few in the slide deck and, you know, discuss what that could potentially look like. So I know there's been some general discussion on soils analysis, ways we can improve that, ways potentially to, you know, remove those thresholds. Staff would say that if we were to look at removing like a soils analysis requirement, we would need to back it up with some other objective findings, which we're just calling like agricultural viability findings. And so what does that even mean? We could require things such as demonstrated agricultural use over a defined historical period, minimum agricultural income, an agricultural management plan, carrying capacity standards, production documentation, whether it's crop sales, things of that nature, or increasing the minimum percentage of parcels in the ag use.
So, go back.
Yep.
Go back.
Back one slide. So on the first bullet, demonstrated agricultural use over a defined historical period. So if an NGO comes in and buys a piece of property, dewaters it, how would you be able to use that bullet?
Yeah, so it would be the historical use, right? So if they came in on year one and then they provided the historical use, that might not be so much an issue, but it would be after the fact, right?
So right, well, it would be a new owner, so it would be a new application.
Yeah.
So there wouldn't be any way for you, for them to show a demonstrated agricultural use unless they intend to do the same thing, but they can't do it without water.
Correct. And we can talk about, so with the contracts, and I'll talk about this in the next few slides, this is a route that the county has not gone yet, and some counties are very strict about this, but they have clear language in their guidelines called like breach of contract requirements. We haven't gone that route. You know, we work with people, we work with the modifications with our general guidelines, but most counties, I mean, they're really strict. They say if you alter the property in any way, you're being non-renewed. So that could be that can be lined out of what we want, right? Water use, is it a change in the type of agriculture that's happening? Is it subdividing the property or, you know, an application submitted for a BLA, right? So those are ways that we could talk further about strengthening that language so our contracts kind of meet what our expectations are now as a county.
And I looked at what the link is.
Yeah.
Without the water, the water has a requirement in the soils analysis.
Yeah.
As well.
Right.
Okay.
Yes. Understood.
So let me go down that path a little more. So with regard to Wildlife Conservation Board funding, mm-hmm. and the requirement that a substantial amount of the water right is given to in-stream flow, I mean, that's kind of, you know, what we're starting to see, and how would we deal with it in what you're talking about currently in these, I guess, you know, potential policy recommendations?
Right. So we could tailor language specific to water that states that, you know, if someone comes in and wants to utilize the water that's different from the historical use, you would be up for non-renewal, right? So we could have some, and I'm just thinking out loud, you know, some sort of language like that, whether it's within our guidelines or whether it's within, you know, the contracting language.
It'd be more substantial in the contract, wouldn't it, than just guidelines?
Potentially, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think a non-renewal takes too long.
Yeah.
Right, with the rollouts, yeah.
To me, if you're completely changing, like they have been in Scott Valley,
right,
that's a breach.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, like I was saying, some counties they're very strict on this breach of contract requirements. Like I said, so to even for them to subdivide, like, you know, 1,000 acres to 100-acre parcels, some counties don't even let that happen. They're like breach of contract. So, but that's on, you know, the PAR side of things. But yeah, I think it's, you know, a tool in our toolbox that we can utilize, you know, just with the issues that are happening at hand.
Well, I think we need to tune this up because I have 5 of these now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, we got a rash of them.
Yep.
And I don't see the state slowing down.
Right.
I was going to save this for later, but I'm going to ask it now.
Okay, yeah, sure.
So, what regulatory options do we have to prevent some of these purchases from the Wildlife Conservation Board? And what I'm keying in on is not so much the Williamson Act contract, but Scott Valley has an area plan that also has what was in your first bullet in it.
Mm-hmm.
That talks about primary purpose of the Scott Valley area plan
mm-hmm.
is to preserve agriculture land by no urbanization or ag development.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have any regulatory mechanism to stop it? I know.
To stop the purchase?
I know planning wise in the other jurisdictions we probably don't, but it sure seems to me we have some legal teeth when it comes to Scott Valley.
Yeah, with potential non-compliance of the area plan or...
I mean, we just seem to be allowing this to happen.
Sure.
And we wouldn't allow that to happen with a developer who lived locally.
Right.
Food for thought.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I did see, too, other counties, when they discuss uses, like allowable uses in their guidelines, they tier it essentially where the primary use has to be an ag production of like a certain scale, and then certain open space uses can occur, but it has to be like secondary or tertiary to the overall, you know, ag operation. So those are, you know, potentially other ways to think about it too. Okay. Potential policy recommendation, clarifying standards for grazing uses. So this is something that we don't really have in our guidelines currently, and just some food for thought for the board to think about. And as I mentioned in earlier slides, a lot of, you know, grazing dominant counties do have some sort of mechanism in their guidelines where they, you know, define and constitute, you know, and what constitutes, you know, commercial grazing standards. And in the later slides, I'm going to be highlighting a few scenarios that we commonly see as staff. And so one of this being, you know, you have a property owner fills out the survey, they have, you know, 1,000 acres, and they're like, I have 2 cows there at any given time, right? As a county, are we going to recognize that as a bona fide commercial use that should receive, you know, the tax reduction? I don't know, right? Those are you know, some policy things to think about. And so, you know, as staff, what we're recommending is maybe drilling down at least some language or parameters within our guidelines so members of the public know what the expectation is. And so it somewhat falls in line closer to what commercial ag is, and that's what we're supporting with the program, right?
One of my focuses has been those unproductive grazing lands.
Yeah.
Most of them have some timber on it. They should be in TPC.
Yes.
And they're not in Williamson Act. And I think as a minimum, we would be able to define a minimum number of animal units per acre.
Yep, for sure.
From a production standpoint, because most of these are early season grazing and they blow out within a month and a half.
Yeah, and I think what the issue that staff runs into with those scenarios is, you know, we can talk about the issues with, you know, certain mechanisms, whether we look up, you know, stocking standards with USDA or whatever, but since we don't have those drilled down requirements, we can't necessarily tell a property owner, hey, this is what we're requiring, because it's not super clear in our guidelines. So something that I think would be a benefit for us to include. And so I wanted to highlight 2 examples on just thinking about, you know, consequences when we do these policy changes and we make any updates. You know, if we were to remove the soils requirement altogether with no other objective standards, no stocking rates, no grazing standards, nothing, right? This is a 160-acre non-prime parcel with class 6 soils, doesn't meet soils, but With our minimum acreage requirements, this would be able to be split up into, you know, 2 80-acre parcels immediately, right? So again, thinking about sprawl, what does that mean for the county? Would that be constituted as supporting the intent of Williamson Ag? Maybe. But just wanted to highlight that for discussion. Next slide. Yes.
Here's another issue with the soils, is the soil classification under TPZ don't line up with the ag soil.
Yeah, absolutely.
There is no such thing as an ag 6,
or a,
an ag 6 in TPZ. Mm-hmm. That's non-commercial.
Right.
So I don't, what I'm looking at here on the picture.
Yeah, yeah.
Isn't ag land, it's TPZ.
Right.
And probably a class 4 or maybe even 5 under the timber regulations.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how we line those up.
Yeah, there are ways we can look into that to better, you know, line it up so it makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Next slide, and you know, again, just a second example, 400 acre non-prime with 40 acre parcel limits within Scott Valley area, you know, class 6 equivalent. And if the con, you know, if there was no soils analysis, it could potentially be sold into multiple 40-acre parcels, right? So just again thinking about consequences of, you know, if we were to remove that requirement, definitely want to be thinking about how to have other objective standards so folks are able to meet those requirements, and then so property isn't continued to be split up into smaller and smaller acres. Another potential policy recommendation that we discussed, you know, the county has added and deleted the Ag Preserve Board a few times throughout the history of the program. So we just brought it up again for discussion, and that can look a few different ways, and it, you know, sometimes adds some buffer between, you know, between staff and the board before a project is taken to the board. So one option we discussed was establishing a clear process where the Ag Preserve Administrator, Ag Commissioner, and Assessor, you know, meet on the issue and provide more of a formal recommendation together, you know, or reestablishing the board altogether. But just, again, another tool to think about, you know, should the board want to discuss that further. Okay, breach of contract. So we talked about this a little already, but a breach of contract occurs when a landowner undertakes or allows a use that is inconsistent with the terms of the recorded contract or adopted preserve rules. Common examples include conversion of land to non-agricultural or non-compatible use, construction or use of structures not permitted under the rules, long-term cessation of required agricultural use without a credible plan to resume, subdivision or development inconsistent with contract restrictions or failure to comply with the conditions imposed as a part of contract approval. So again, you know, we haven't really taken the stance with breach of contract processes, but that's definitely something, you know, staff can bring forward with a guideline update. And so some legal considerations, just wanted to highlight some scenarios for the board to think about and you know, why it creates risk. So as we're thinking about potential policy recommendations and considerations, we need to, you know, understand that, you know, two parcels cannot be treated differently when we have guideline updates. It has to be applied fairly to everybody. And so obviously there's naturally consequences that come with that. We shouldn't have approvals based on staff judgment. That's super subjective. That creates a lot of risk. We want objective, clear standards that are applied to everybody. We don't want unwritten exceptions granted, so we don't want to approve things without giving a basis for that, because that obviously creates some risk. We don't want to rely on historical practice without findings, so hey, this happened in, you know, 1995, it should still stand today. You know, rules change, guidelines change, property is sold and subdivided, and so you have to look at things in current time. Also, we shouldn't have vague standards like adequate agriculture, right? What does that mean? You know, what does bona fide agricultural, you know, commercial ag, you know, ag mean? So better ways to define those obviously help staff and county in general. So some staff recommendations of what not to do. So staff currently is not recommending to eliminate the minimum acreage requirements entirely. We are not recommending to allow hobby or lifestyle farming. We are not recommending broad sub 40 acre eligibility. We are not recommending automatic approvals without findings, and we are not recommending weakening enforcement or monitoring language. Next slide. So just to expand on our 40 acre minimums, just for some additional context, you know, if there was a policy recommendation to lower non-prime to 20 or something like that, that would have major unintended financial consequences for the county. It would increase administrative workload, and we would legally potentially have to take in about 47,000 acres of property. So as you can imagine, with our 600,000 ticket right now, that would be much higher. Next slide. So this is just an example of a property changing since contract creation. So we see this issue a lot. You know, the initial contract was for, you know, hundreds or thousands of acres, and over time, you know, parcels have been sold off, multi-owner contracts have been able to split up, and so now, you know, the initial property was one parcel, one or two homes. Now is, you know, five different parcels, five different homes, right? So this is just to highlight the common changes that we already see occurring that are legal to occur, right, within the frames of the guidelines that we currently have. So just for some additional context. Next slide. Other options for non-qualifying lands. So there are other options that folks seek if they cannot meet the current guidelines of the Williamson Act. So leasing agreements, you know, we offer that recommendation to a lot of folks where, let's say, you know, they're retired or older and they still want to keep their, you know, parcel within the Williamson Act contract. They are more than able to seek a leasing agreement, so the land is still utilized for commercial ag purposes. Obviously, as we've seen a lot lately, property owners are getting into conservation easements with land trusts or just selling the property altogether. There are other state property tax programs such as tax postponement, veterans exemption, Prop 19, and there's also other various federal, state, or private grants that landowners apply for, particularly through groups like USDA. Next slide. So we just wanted to highlight a few common scenarios of what we see as staff, and I just wanted to you know, briefly go over these and whether or not they would meet our current guidelines. So scenario one, owner has 300 acres of non-prime land but only has 5 cows on the entire property at any given time. Current data will show that the owner is below carrying capacity of the property. The owner does not want to lease out the property. So would it meet the requirements? No, that's because commercial agriculture is not evident. Scenario two, a family has 1,000 acre property. Family sells off the parcel to multiple family members. Now a property owner only has 40 acres. That does not meet soils and does not meet the carrying capacity. The owner will not qualify on his own and does not want to be included in the larger family farm ownership, because we do allow for that to happen, you know, contiguously. Does it meet current requirements? No, because commercial agriculture is not evident and it is not part of a larger operation. Next slide. Scenario three, 80 acre property that meets soils and meets carrying capacity. Does it meet the Williamson Act guidelines? The answer is yes. Scenario four, there is a 100 acre property that meets soils, meets the carrying capacity, but is in a multi-owner contract. Does it meet the guidelines? The answer is no, because it needs to be a part of a single owner contract.
So what do you mean by multi? Are you saying, like, of the 100, there's four parties that each own 25 acres?
And they're all under one contract, right? So we see this a lot because obviously as time, people sell off their property and then the county's not notified, right? So then 40 years passes, that's a lot of land transaction that occurs. And so it's a lot of it actually is unbeknownst to the property owner a lot, you know, they had no idea, and so then, you know, they find out that.
So what if it's a partnership?
That's fine. We allow for, you know, farm ownership, LLC partnerships, things like that to occur. Okay, so last two scenarios. So there is a 40-acre parcel that does not meet soils. It is utilized for seasonal grazing of replacement heifers, meeting carrying capacity of grazing standards. It's under, this property is under the ownership of a large agricultural operation with over 800 acres where the remainder of the property is not under Williamson Act. Does it meet the Williamson Act guidelines? No, because it does not meet soils and that the entire parcel is not under contract. Last scenario. So there is a 100-acre parcel that meets soils requirements. It's developed with residential structures, barns, equipment storage areas. Of the 100 acres, 20 is an alfalfa hayfield, 65 is open space. The parcel is under contract and includes three additional parcels, and all of them are entirely in hay production. Does it meet Williamson requirements? The answer is yes. So I just wanted to go through a few of these because these are, you know, common issues that we find, and, you know, just wanting to support my earlier recommendation that it would be in our best interest to have more objective, you know, ag, commercial ag standards and, you know, some grazing standards in there. So everything is easier to understand both on the public side and staff side, so we're not as subjective. But that concludes my presentation. I know that was very long, so I'm happy to answer any other questions.
I don't really have any questions other than I think that, you know, we need to work through some of the things that you discussed and kind of figure out where we need to land on them.
Okay. Yep.
I think it's a great presentation. I think some works in progress is always, you know, I think I've always felt that, you know, we are basically subsidizing people, and I get the ag piece to it. I truly do, but it's the non-compliant people that I think we're still working through. So to me, there's no rush to try to change something. Let's get through what we're Bernadette's making a career out of back there. And, you know, and again, you know, I like the context of what other counties are doing. I wish it was all uniform, to be honest with you. But having said that, I'll just deal with Siskiyou County as we're dealing with. I will tell you personally, I'm disappointed that I don't see people that are affected by this in the audience asking questions or contacting us. You know, I would have expected the Farm Bureau, you know, anyone in that world to say, this is how it's affected me, or this is why it's a benefit for me, and this is why I can only do X on a certain amount of time, that kind of thing. So thank you for the presentation. It's well, very informative.
Thank you.
Any other thing? Now they can go.
Yeah.
Time.
I know. I do think we have some more work to do. I think I'd like to see it, you know, a little bit more specific, more detailed.
Sure.
And it's, you know, I know the bulk of the work has to be done in Scott Valley. And we need to look at the Scott Valley plan a little bit more to make sure that things fit the right way. It's so, it's just so.
There's a lot of factors.
There are a lot of things that have to be taken into consideration.
Yeah.
And sometimes more vague is better, but I don't think so in this particular instance. And I'm not sure that we're ever going to get exactly what we need.
Sure.
But I don't think it has to be etched in stone either. I think it can be a living document.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we just need to get it as fine-tuned as we can, and then we can always revisit it again. It doesn't have to be forever.
Yep.
So, 2 cents.
My scenario.
Yes.
and the Williamson Act that qualifies, and 5 acres is fully consumed by homes and infrastructure. How is that taxed?
I think the homes are at market.
Yes.
Yeah, so the assessor takes
so
that.
How, But how does the land itself underneath the home exempt from taxation?
No.
Here comes the authority.
I'm going to ask the assessor many questions.
It's been permanently removed from ag.
Okay. It depends. So if the assessor's office has carved that out into its own separate assessor's parcel number, it's taxed separately. So it's none of that 5 acres.
Including the soil.
Right.
Okay.
Is under that. But if it's still within, I believe it's the entire land acreage that's at the discounted rate.
So, okay. So it's not uniform, is what I just heard.
Correct.
Which is interesting. The other question I had then too is, so if somebody decides to encumber another acre with additional infrastructure, what's the process for going through that and adjusting the Williamson Act contract?
That would be a rescission and reentry, right? So if you're bringing in more land to your contract, then you would submit.
Well, I thought you'd be carving another acre off of what's in the existing contract.
Yeah, to like the market value side of things.
I don't know. Do you know where it is?
It's the assessment.
It's the assessment. So they would have to deal with the assessor's office, but I'm not sure exactly what that process is.
A couple things for me. Going forward, I kind of, what I'm looking for is being nimble.
Yep.
And being able to limit staff time on these things, because apparently, looking at these over the years, they're pure bureaucracy, and as I observe things, and there's a lot of government process involved. And the reason why I bring that up is, going forward, I see an awful lot of what were family ranches for a very long time under a Williamson Act that are being sold.
Yep.
And sold for legitimate agricultural purposes. But with that type of ownership, there's more frequent turnover.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't imagine us doing, five times these 10 years from now because of this constant turnover. It happens in timberlands all the time, and I'm sure it's coming to us in ag. So whatever we do, look 10 years out and what the workload's going to be on the county.
Okay.
And we'll talk more about the Scott Bell area plan, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
So I'm interested in getting into the contract piece more so than the guidelines on some of the, I guess, hardline things that are going to be included versus having, a little bit of flexibility that deals with commercial ag. And I don't know how we do that, but I mean, the contract piece interests me, versus, I mean, I know that it can be a living document on the guidelines, but the contract we need to be more consistent on, I think, overall. And the other part of this is, I'm not all gung-ho about, the cost to the consumer. Just throwing more expense on, well, you have to do X, Y, or Z because now it's a new parcel or a new ownership. There needs to be a smooth transaction or transition without, $10,000 being at stake to just be able to be in compliance.
Sure.
And then lastly, I know we've been working through some of these contracts that, for instance, I-5 split from, the parcels that were historically one. I mean, those are considerations that the landowner can't control.
Right.
And we somehow, I don't know, it's not incumbent upon us to just force it on them just because of ordinance or guideline. There has to be a bit of discretion and flexibility in those cases where, it's just common sense.
Yep, okay.
I think that's it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, finally getting to item E, Mr. Shinone, and it looks like he left the room.
Yes, Angela Davis, County Administrator. Mr. Shinone, Director of Emergency Services, had to attend to an incident in Doris. We have hazmat spill, so
He is attending to that, and the request is to extend this item.
So moved.
Second.
All right, Supervisor Valenzuela?
Yep.
Supervisor Oprin?
Aye.
Oh, sorry, Supervisor Cobson?
Aye.
Supervisor Harris?
Aye.
And Supervisor Howe?
Aye.
Item 8A, emergency related proliferation of illegal cannabis.
Angela Davis, County Administrator. The sheriff also needed to attend the incident, and so upon his request is to extend this item as well.
So moved.
Second.
There we go. Supervisor Valenzuela?
Yep.
Supervisor Oprin?
Aye.
Supervisor Cobson?
Aye.
Supervisor Harris?
Aye.
And Supervisor Howe?
Aye.
Thank you.
All right, I'll recess the Board of Supervisors and convene the Flood Control and Water Conservation District. Item 9A, public comment.
Showing none online.
Seeing none in house. Item B1, Flood Control Natural Resources.
Move to approve consent agenda.
Second.
Is that right. Item 1 and 2?
1 and 2 would be
yeah.
Consent,
right.
Yes. Alrighty, Director Valenzuela.
Yep.
Director Oprin.
Aye.
Director Cobsett.
Aye.
Director Harris.
Aye.
And Director Howe.
Aye.
Minute approval.
I've received no corrections for those.
Move to approve.
Second.
Alrighty, Director Valenzuela.
Yep.
Director Oprin.
Aye.
Director Cobsett.
Abstain.
Director Harris.
Aye.
And Director Howe.
Aye.
Adjourn the Flood Control and Water Conservation District. Reconvene the Siskiyou County Board of Supervisors. Appointments 10A, County Clerk, Gazelle, Fire Department.
We have here an appointment of two members to unscheduled vacancies on the Gazelle Fire Protection District. This is due to the resignations of Linda and John Elsnab. Both terms are short term, ending December 3rd of 2027. The district was unable to appoint within their time frame, and the Board of Supervisors can make an appointment no later than today. And it looks like we have letters of interest from, I have Patricia Creshrew and James Creshrew. And it looks like they're both eligible and interested in serving.
Move to appoint both of them.
Second.
Supervisor Valenzuela?
Okay.
Supervisor Oprin?
Aye.
Supervisor Cobson?
Aye.
Supervisor Harris?
Aye.
And Supervisor Howe?
Aye.
11A, minute approval, March 3rd.
No corrections heard.
Move to approve.
Second.
Supervisor Valenzuela?
Okay.
Supervisor Oprin?
Aye.
Supervisor Cobson?
Abstain.
Supervisor Harris?
Aye.
And Supervisor Howe?
Aye.
I'm going to go to board and staff, of course, before we go to close, and I'm going to pass.
I'll pass.
I did, real quick, I was down in Folsom for PRISM's board meeting, always learning something there. One of the issues that you'll hear is tort reform, they call them nuclear verdicts that are affecting insurance rates across the board, particularly in the workman's comp area. With that, I'll leave it there.
I chaired the Golden State Natural Resources board here this last month, remotely. Next GSNR meeting will be in Lassen County in April. Also, I attended with Klamath Water Users a Washington, D.C. lobbying trip, which was very productive from March 1st through March 4th.
All right. That will
one other thing I got to bring up. I'm sorry. It's quick. We need to explore the possibility of putting a predator advisory committee together. It's an ad hoc committee from this board. I don't know what that looks like. And it's something to the effect of two from each supervisorial district like we have on other committees for that, but between wolves, bears, and lions. There's a good cross-section in all of our districts, and it's probably time to establish something along that nature. So whatever that can look like coming before the board for consideration.
Duly noted.
Thank you.
With that, we'll recess the open session and go to closed.